Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, reflections on a war that refuses to end. Beginning in 2003, Elliot Ackerman served 5 tours as a Marine in Iraq and Afghanistan, including fighting in the fierce battle for Fallujah, where he earned the Silver Star and a Purple Heart. Ackerman eventually left the Marines, but he continues to return to his experiences in the Middle East as a writer. In 2013, he traveled back to the region to find an intensifying conflict in Syria, an Islamic State on the rise, and war that just goes on and on. It's the basis for his new memoir, Places and Names, on War, Revolutions, and Returning. I talked with Elliot Ackerman last week on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Elliot Ackerman, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me why, after you had served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan as a Marine, you wanted to return in 2013, this time as a journalist.
I mean, those experiences were very much defining for me. I would say it's almost like you've become an expatriate of those places, and that those places have always changed you. And then when you return home, the way they've changed you is really held in stark relief. And there's an allure to try to go back to understand the experience with some time that's spaced it out. And so I think the combination of that impulse, also combined with the fact that the wars, even though we had declared them over, particularly Iraq in 2011, they hadn't ended. The story was still going on. The places, the names of the places were still in the news. And so I wanted to go back and understand what was going on again.
Tell me how you arranged to get back to especially Fallujah.
I think one of the things that's remarkable, and particularly among those of us who fought in the wars, is when you're with the U.S. military and you deploy to a war zone, it's a pretty elaborate process. It takes days to get there. You're staged at a base in the U.S., then you probably fly into Germany. You spend a day or two in Germany, and then you fly into Kuwait. You spend a week in Kuwait, and it's this great journey to get into the war zone. As a civilian, it's remarkably easy.
Really?
Oh, yes. So when I went to back to Fallujah, I was living in Istanbul at the time, and a good friend of mine was the New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul and Baghdad, and he was between the two. And we were out for dinner one night in Istanbul, and he had come back from the third battle of Fallujah, which was fought by the Iraqis, and we were talking about it. I looked at him and said, you know, man, I don't know. I would love to go back. I would just be so fascinated to go back. I feel jealous of you that you were able to cover that. And he just looked at me and said, why don't you just go back? Let's go back. Well, we'll set it up. You can stay at the New York Times house. I mean, Fallujah, and it is. It's only about a 50-minute drive from Baghdad. He's like, we'll set the whole thing up. And so we set that up. Ironically, what wound up happening when I traveled back to Fallujah was we had set this up, and he was going to drive in there with me. We were going to basically make a day trip of it. And then the offensive into Mosul began. And so as I was flying into Baghdad, I got a call from literally 18 hours before my flight was going to leave. Hey, Elliot, so sorry. I'm not going to be in Baghdad to facilitate your transport into Fallujah. I'm going to be up in Mosul or in Erbil, which is in the north, covering the battle for Mosul. But you can stay at the house, and best of luck to you. And fortunately, I had a few friends of mine who are Iraqis who are sort of my backup contacts that I was able to work with to get into Fallujah, but it involved getting permissions from the Iraqi government. And
paying a $500 bribe. Or at least they asked for
it. They asked for it, and I didn't have to ultimately pay the bribe.
Didn't have to pay it.
It was not assured that we would be able to get back into the city.
Why do you think they let you back in?
I don't think they really knew that they were letting me back in per se, and I write about this. I didn't want to tell people why I was going back. You know, I felt like it's sort of like showing up in New Orleans. If your name is Hurricane Katrina, you would not be particularly welcome. It would be very complicated. You know, however, the Iraqis who were showing me around, I mean, you know, they're smart people. They soon figured out, you know, like, who is this American? You know, and why is he so interested in going to these very specific, nondescript places in the city? And, you know, and those were the places where I had fought, the specific shop fronts and houses where certain battles had taken place. And so, you know, I was very, very particular in where I wanted to go in the city, and, you know, and ultimately told them, you know, I'd fought here.
Especially the candy store.
The candy store was a building where our platoon, we found ourselves one day surrounded. And I had actually never seen it properly from the outside in daylight, because when we occupied this building, it was in the middle of the night. We fought from inside of it for an entire day, our platoon wound up getting surrounded. And when we had to leave the candy store, there was only one door in and out of it, and it was covered by a machine gun. So we had to basically blow a hole in the far side of the candy store. So we left it kind of in this chaos of dust and debris and fire. So I'd never really seen it, although I knew where it was. And I very much wanted to go and stand there and see it.
Read for us.
I quickly find the candy store where insurgents surrounded my platoon the day after Dan was killed. That morning, at 3 o'clock, we had crossed Highway 10 in advance of a larger assault of nearly 1,000 Marines that was scheduled for later that morning. I had never seen the candy store from the outside in daylight. "This is the place," I tell Hare. He begins to shoot photos, which only increases the suspicions of our Iraqi escorts. They toss furtive glances in my direction and whisper among themselves. The sign affixed to the side of the structure is in English. It reads, "Moonlight Supermarket." A rusted mesh fence, padlocked shut, encircles the building. I climb up the side. By the time I am on the rooftop, I am covered in familiar dust. I recognize not so much the building as the vantages it offers. The view from where we set in our machine guns so they could rake a long street. The approach where we waited desperately for an armored ambulance as one of the Marines who'd been shot through the femoral artery was bleeding to death. The southeastern corner where I crouched alongside my platoon sergeant, who in his early 30s seemed infinitely old and wise, seconds before he was shot in the head, only to miraculously survive. The spot in the basement where we placed bricks of C4 explosive when, surrounded as we were, our company commander ordered us to advance further into the city, and we knew going out the front door would be suicide, so we blew open a door of our own, understanding that a single miscalculation would cause the entire building to collapse on top of us. I try to imagine this place differently, not as a battlefield, but as a community of homes and businesses. Many of our most iconic cities, Rome, Istanbul, Athens, have a layered architectural aesthetic, each population having built on what its predecessors created. Fallujah is different. It is defined not by creation, but rather by destruction. My eyes cast out in specific directions, searching for hard-fought neighborhoods and alleyways, for unrepaired scars on buildings. I am searching for the marks we left behind. I see them everywhere, commingled with the marks left by others. They have become the city, both battlefield and home.
Elliot, what's remarkable to me is that after that battle, you had to go back because your commanding officer said, you have to clear the place. What did that feel like?
During the Fallujah battle, there was a lot of pressure because this was the second battle. So if you recall, in the spring, there'd been a first battle in which the Marines and coalition forces had been really bogged down in the city. So there was this pressure to get it done quickly and to be able to announce that the Marines had cleared from north to south and reached the southern end of the city. So as we were going, we were advancing hundreds of meters each day, but we knew, and I say we, I mean all of us, every Marine in the battle, you know, we knew, and down to the individual, you know, Lance Corporal or Private First Class in my platoon, that we were bypassing lots of insurgents who were held up in various buildings. And so there was sort of this question of, well, what's going to happen when we get to the southern end of the city? And after about a week of fighting, we got to the south end of the city, and the inevitable answer was, well, we're going to go back and we're going to re-clear it out house by house by house by house. And that's literally what they did. When we hit the south end of the city, we were then handed out maps and the maps had, there were satellite images, and they literally had every single house in the city was given a number. And for the next month, we would go out on patrol and we would clear every single house. And people have since asked me, you know, what's the bravest thing you saw anyone do in Fallujah? I was like, unequivocally, the bravest thing I saw was, you know, the young, like private first class, Lance Corporal, the youngest Marines who were the first ones into a house each day. And they would wake up every day, they'd go, they'd kick in the front door, and they would have no idea whether the house was empty or whether there was a group of two or three insurgents with a machine gun trained on the door. And it was this massive game of Russian roulette that was played for a month.
And you decided to keep your uniform.
When we went into the city, you could only take whatever you could carry. And all of us were weighed down by, you know, the true essentials, which were water, ammunition, a little bit of food. And then past that, you know, anything else you decided you wanted to bring, you would be carrying for the next month. So most of us decided, you know, we're not going to bring an extra uniform, just the bare essentials. So, you know, I wore the same uniform for about a month and, you know, didn't have a shower for a month. And so when the battle was finally over and or over enough, so they pulled us out of the city and said, you're going to get to go back to Camp Fallujah, which was a staging base, and everyone's going to get a hot meal and a shower. You know, I took off this uniform and was given a replacement uniform. And sort of the question became, well, what do you do with this thing? You know, do you throw it away? Well, I couldn't throw it away. I mean, it was, you know, it had blood stains, sweat stains on it. I mean, I didn't want to throw it away. So I folded it up and I put it in a plastic bag. And I was somewhat worried when I was flying back that maybe it would be, you know, confiscated at customs and I would get in trouble for it being a biohazard. But I eventually took the plastic bag and, you know, stuck it in storage down in the basement of my house. You know, and sometimes I will go and look at it. But the, you know, the question in subsequent years has always lingered, like, what am I supposed to do with that uniform? Like, I'm not going to, who am I going to give it to? You know, like my medals, you know, I've decided I'll give to my daughter, and I have a watch, which is my war watch, and I'll, you know, give that to my son when he's old enough. But like this uniform, like, kind of, who is it for?
How do you answer that question?
I don't know.
You lost a number of good friends.
I'm 39 years old. I sometimes feel like I'm about 85
because
of the amount of friends that you've lost along the way.
Really? Close friends with whom you were in battle.
You know, and that's unfortunate, and that's the cost of war.
Did that prompt you to write this book, or did you write it because you really wanted us as civilians to understand what war is really about?
It's sort of a tough question, Dan, because so much of a book is written by your subconscious. So you don't even understand why you're writing it, or even if you're writing it as the act is going on. I was actually living in Turkey, traveling to Syria a lot, writing a different book, which was a novel called Dark at the Crossing, which came out in 2017. And I was in London, actually, over a long weekend. My girlfriend and I both found ourselves there. So we sort of had this nice little oasis, and we spent a day, you know, had this day together in London. We were in the National Portrait Gallery. We were walking through the National Portrait Gallery, and we came to this portrait of the writer Edmund Burke. And Edmund Burke very famously wrote a book called Reflections on the Revolution in France. And my girlfriend, who's much smarter than I am, started explaining to me, you know, one of the interesting things Burke was doing, Elliot, in that book was he was writing about the French Revolution. But if you actually read the book, what he was really writing about was the British and their failed experience in the American colonies. But he was using the French Revolution and his observations of the French Revolution as a tool to write about the British failure. You know, with this idea that when you look at one thing and something else stares back at you, that's a reflection. I said, oh, that's interesting. And she looked at me and she had been reading a lot of these dispatches, journalistic dispatches I'd been filing along the way that in my mind were not a book. They were just these bits of journalism I was doing. She said, that's what you're doing. Don't you see it? She's like, you're writing a book. And that was the first time I said, oh, I think I am. Oh my God, maybe I am writing a book. Maybe all these little dispatches and misses of nonfiction are a book. And I started looking at the arc of everything that I had written as a journalist and realized, I think this is a book. And I've been kind of wrestling with, you know, the meaning of these experiences, you know, both in my fiction, but, you know, also in my nonfiction. And that was sort of the genesis of this project as taking shape in book form.
Quick break. More from Elliot Ackerman when we come back.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
Now here's the rest of my conversation with Elliot Ackerman. His new memoir is titled Places and Names on War, Revolutions, and Returning. You and I happened to be speaking on the day that the U.S. began its extraordinary invasion, D-Day, trying to rescue Europe, Britain, and France. And here you are speaking to me on this day. What reflections do you make in your own mind between what memorializing today and what you did back then in Fallujah?
You know, what interests me the most in writing about conflict and war is that it's sort of fundamental to the human condition. I mean, this is something, going to war, sad as it is, it's something we have done, it's something we will always do. And understanding it is also tantamount to understanding humanity and the darker side of humanity. Then there's also this impulse to return. And so the title of the book is Places and Names on War, Revolution, and Returning. And the last one, Returning, is sort of a double entendre. It maybe means returning home, but it also means war, revolution, and then returning to the two again and revisiting them. And I think anyone who has experienced war continues throughout their life to revisit those experiences because those experiences made them. I think what we see today on the 75th anniversary of D-Day is that that generation is still revisiting them. You know, I looked at the paper.
97, 98 year old.
Right. I think you saw the front page of the Washington Post is a 97-year-old paratrooper parachuting into the landing zone he'd gone in years before. You know, and you know, that's someone who I'm sure throughout his life has revisited and been formed by that set of experiences as a person. And I'm sure as a 97-year-old, that person has gone on to do many, many, many things that have nothing to do with what he did when he was probably in his 20s. But everything else he's done was probably also informed by who he was in his 20s and that set of experiences that began, I guess, on D-Day for him.
You say in the book that when you returned, a lot of people asked you whether you had killed anyone. And you had kind of a hard time coming to the response to that, especially since the first person who asked you was your 6-year-old niece.
Well, I always thought it was sort of a remarkable question. It was a pretty personal question. And I was always surprised how many people whom I hardly knew would ask me this question. But I kind of took a journey with that question and began to understand that someone who asked it probably wasn't necessarily trying to be rude, but was trying to actually make a real connection with you and try to understand what that experience meant. And so, you know, a friend of mine, because I think many, many veterans have been asked this question, told me, and it was the response I took to taking. He said, well, if anyone ever asked me that, I say, well, if I did kill anyone, you paid me to, which is a fair statement because as taxpayers, you know, we all contribute to those wars, and it's not just our military that goes to war. It's everybody else who, you know, our whole society that goes into these wars, depending on how much they participate in them. But at the same time, I reflect that, you know, that response, although witty, I thought it was, isn't wholly sufficient because the first person who asked me was my 6-year-old niece, and she doesn't pay taxes. And so it's a question of, you know, what does that mean? And what does it say about, you know, all of humanity, where encoded into us is this capacity for making war.
For making war and for perhaps seeing the face of one's enemy. How often did that happen? Much of what you report from the roof of the candy store is at a distance. What was it like, or did you come face to face with the enemy that you knew it was either your life or his life?
I mean, some of the fighting I was involved in was at, pretty close quarters. But there's also this question of, when the war is over, what happens to the warriors? And something that, I've always believed is that the people who fought in the wars, who you would think at face value would be the holders of the greatest antipathy to the people they fought against, are often the ones who are the most quick and the most ready to bury the old grudge. And I think we've seen that in previous generations. I think, one of the most moving and powerful things was that, people often forget that the normalization of relations between the U.S. and Vietnam, was spearheaded by Senators John McCain and Senators Kerry, who bore the brunt of that conflict. And so in my, my writings, when I was traveling in southern Turkey, at a certain point, I had the opportunity to sit down with a gentleman who became a friend who had fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Al-Anbar province where I fought. And so the book gets into a series of conversations we had where we talk about, our wars. And I think our desire to sit down with one another was really born out of a deep curiosity. Because as I say, the war defined and made me. And the war itself, when you're engaged in it, it feels, that you're engaged in a dance. And it's a shadow dance because you have a partner, but you never see your partner. And for years and years and years, you're doing this dance. And for years and years and years, you never really get to see or speak to your partner. And so sitting down with this individual, his name was Abu Hassar, who fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq. When we first sat down, the gamble I made was that he would want to sit down with me and that we would have this significant common ground, because just as he had been, the shadow I was dancing with, I was the shadow that he had been dancing with, and we would find that we had been similarly defined.
But you came as a journalist.
Mm-hmm, I did.
And he was there as having fought in the war. Both of you did not really say that to each other until a little later.
Right. For sort of the first 30 minutes, there was when we first sat down over tea and in a little town right on the Turkish-Syrian border where he was living in a refugee camp, and I'd been given an introduction to him, but said that I had been in Iraq and wanted to speak with him, but I'd been there as a journalist 10 years before, and he was willing to meet me. And so there was, first 30 minutes where I think we were both a little cagey and leery of each other, and we talked and we loosened up a little bit. And at a certain point, a friend of mine, a Syrian named Abed, who was translating, I asked Abed, I said, "Do you think I can tell him?" He said, "Yeah, I think you can tell him." And I told him, and he sort of leaned back and smiled at me and said, "I thought so." And then, our conversation really opened up.
Really extraordinary. And did it become truly friendly?
It became truly friendly. There are certain, and this is in the book, there are certain issues where he and I are never going to agree.
Such as
he still subscribes to a very fundamentalist and I would say radicalized view of Islam that believes in visions of the apocalypse that are coming, that end of days battles, the return of the Mahdi, and this is what he believes with his whole heart, and I don't believe it. And we would talk in those terms, but then there would be, moments where we had experiences that were very similar, and that we'd been fighting in the same western deserts of Iraq, that he had a great curiosity about me, that we were both fathers and of a similar age, and talked a little bit about our kids. So I'm inherently an optimist by nature, and part of me believes that peace and reconciliation, is a personal and intimate act, and it kind of comes from people just reaching out and saying, "Are you as curious about me as I am is about you?" And in the case of Abu Hassar, his answer was yes, and that's why we met.
We still have troops in Iraq, and now there is the threat of sending them into Iran. What feelings do you have about that?
I think our country is in a real position of moral hazard right now in terms of how we have arranged ourselves to make war. And what I mean by that specifically is that unlike the Second World War, which we were talking about, where there was a national draft, there was a war bond effort to fight the war, or even Vietnam, where there was a draft that caused all sorts of political pressure to end the war after it had gone on for too long. Today, we fund our wars through deficit spending. So it just, whatever funding goes in the war, it's largely thrown into the deficit, so there aren't any new taxes. And we man our wars through an all-volunteer military, so nobody who doesn't want to serve has to. And so it really anesthetizes us to war making as a society. And so we ask these questions of, you know, how come our forever wars are going on so long? I mean, if we look at, for instance, the war in Afghanistan, it's 2019. This year marks the first time in the history of our country that somebody can walk into an armed forces recruitment office, enlist in the U.S. military to go fight in a war that is older than they are. That's never happened before. And in my opinion, the reason it's happened is because of how we've arranged these wars, that they're funded through our deficit and they're fought by an all-volunteer military. And I think it makes it too easy for us to go to war. And my concern is because it's so easy, we could find ourselves sleepwalking our way into a truly disastrous war like one in Iran that you just mentioned.
Why do you think that would be so disastrous?
Because we have a distorted view of what war is and how painless it is, and that this isn't a big deal. You know, we've been fighting a war in Afghanistan. Are we even still fighting that war? According to one poll in 2018, 40% of Americans didn't even know whether or not we were fighting a war in Afghanistan still, which is chilling. So that when the sabers start rattling, you know, we've stopped paying attention. Well, who are we up? Is it North Korea this time? Is it Iran? No, we don't really care. We never go to war. And even if we do, you know, it's not going to be my kid. It's not going to be my pocketbook that's affected. And that's how nations sleepwalk their ways into wars that are far beyond the scope of what they could have ever imagined, sort of situations like the Guns of August in 1914.
I want to ask you about Bo Bergdahl and the fact that he was captured and then released by the Taliban. What were your thoughts at that time?
Well, it was actually remarkable because I was living in Istanbul when he was released, and I had been introduced to an American writer who just got out of the military, a guy named Nate Bethay, and he had passed through Istanbul for 3 or 4 days. And you know, we'd hung out together and just chatted, and then he left, and a very nice guy. And then Bergdahl was released, and I saw the announcement on the news, and I immediately had an email from Nate, and he said, I don't know if you know this, but Bo Bergdahl was in my company. I was in the same unit as him, and I had no idea it hadn't come up before. And talking to Nate and having also served in the same part of Afghanistan where Bergdahl had gone missing shortly after he had gone missing, you know, I always felt that what happened was Bo Bergdahl kind of became, and I write about this a little bit, kind of became like a Jonah, meaning in the story in the Bible, Jonah becomes the root of all discontent for the people who he was on the same ship with. So if anything that happened on the ship, the reason it happened that was bad was because of Jonah. And so in maritime culture, if you have a Jonah on the ship, it means you have someone who's bringing you bad luck. And Bergdahl, I think for many, had become the Jonah of our Afghan voyage. If the Taliban set an ambush, well, it was because they had learned new tactics because Bergdahl was telling them about it. And so he almost became like a Rorschach test among Afghan veterans. You could ask an Afghan veteran, what do you think about Bergdahl? And based off of their response, I think you could find out what type of a war that they had had. And I think there was also a sort of bitter irony that the most iconic figure of the Afghan war, which is a war most Americans have deserted and stopped thinking about long ago, was in fact a deserter himself.
And his life since then?
I think has been very challenging.
Challenging, to say the least.
Yeah.
You served 5 tours. Why did you decide the 5th would be your last?
I think one of the things that's been interesting about these wars, because they've gone on so long, is, you know, unlike the Second World War or Vietnam or any other war, which have clearly ended, you know, been marked with a surrender ceremony on a battleship or even helicopters flying off the roof of the CIA station in Saigon, these wars haven't ended as clearly. And so everyone who has left them has had to declare a separate peace, say, you know, you might be, you know, to their friends, you might be going back for the next deployment, but I'm not. I'm done. I'm going to go do whatever else it is I want to do with my life. And so I know many people who've done far more than 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. you know, for me, the decision was a personal one. You know, I just had my first child. There were other things I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to write. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to go out there and not, I decided I didn't want to spend my entire life in the Marine Corps. And so it seemed like this was the moment to declare that separate piece for me.
Did any of your buddies try to talk you out of that? And did you regret leaving some of them behind?
Some did. I think it's very emotional. It's almost like going through a breakup. It's tough to look your best friends who you're extremely close with in the eye and say, I'm not coming on the next one. And, you know, for me, in one case, there was an expectation that I would be on the next one. And I said that I wasn't going to be. And I think that was tough. I don't regret the choice to leave, but I think all of us wish that we didn't have to carry the burden of declaring our own separate peace, that the wars could have just finished and we could have gone on with our lives.
Elliot Ackerman, thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for this extraordinary book.
Thanks, Dan.
That's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urev-Livker. I'll be back with you on Friday. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.